Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Mythology, I am proud to bring you Sword and Sandal Cinema. Today is a double show, and we'll have two hosts. We will have Setna Kamwes, also known as Michael K. Waterman, in segment one, and we have Brian Walker of Brian's Dryden Theater in segment two. And now, without further ado, Setna Kamwes. Greetings, my friend. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing wonderfully. Have you dug out from the snow yet?
Yes, we're dug out from the snow. Unfortunately, I couldn't dig today, but Athena and our son dug admirably, and then it started to get warm, so it started melting. So
you're going to hate me. It was sunny all day here and 72 degrees.
No, I'm glad for you.
No, this is the first time in, so what, I guess, 51 years that I didn't have to. Ever since I was 11 or so, I've been shoveling snow. Well, let's get to it, okay? Shall
okay.
we?
The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. That sounds awesome.
Yes, it is, and nothing says sword and sandals more than, literally sandals, more than Sinbad the Sailor. He was one of my heroes growing up. He was one of the stories from the Arabian Nights. I'm sure you might not know that, written by Scheherazade,
yes.
So they say.
And
like Hercules, Sinbad was kind of the Arabic Hercules. He had many adventures. This is one of my favorites. This and Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves and the Thief of Baghdad. We'll get into those another time. This is a wonderful version. John Law is Sinbad. He's very handsome and very interesting. But for me, I'm a Doctor Who fan. So
okay.
Tom Baker, who's one of my favorite Doctor Who's ever, plays exactly the opposite. He plays a horrible, terrible Grand Vizier who's a black prince and a wizard, a terrible wizard. On behalf of wizards everywhere, I apologize to all of you. This is a very bad, it makes wizards look very bad. But what happens is that Sinbad is on one of his voyages, as Hercules often is, and somewhere flying around the sky is some little creature. I will say a Ray Harryhausen, one of my heroes, inventions. It's a winged little demon, and in its paw or claws is a gold piece of an amulet. And one of the men on the boat shoots it down and scares the poor little thing, and it drops the amulet at Sinbad's feet. One of the other crewmen says, "Oh, this is a bad omen." Sinbad giggles because Sinbad is like Hercules. Nothing bothers him. He says, "Ha, ha, ha, ha. Don't be ridiculous." He puts it around his neck. Well, and from there, things get worse. The wizard knows something's wrong. He whips up a storm to ruin the boat, and it doesn't. It ends up on the shore where he is because Sinbad's a good navigator. So they end up in a wonderful world, and the first thing that happens, of course, is the wizard knows that Sinbad has landed. So Tom Baker says to John Law, "Give me my amulet." It's like giving my ruby slippers, you know? Anyway, Sinbad tricks the assistant of the wizard, gets on a horse, which conveniently is there, and he runs to the kingdom. And who does he run into? The Grand Vizier, who is the appointed successor to the caliph, the king. And he says, "Oh, we've been waiting for you for years." And Sinbad says, "Really?" So he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "I've got to show you something." Now, what's weird about the Grand Vizier, when you first see him, is his face is encased, if you remember, Hercules, in a gigantic gold helmet. It has a mustache and beard. And when they get into a secret part of the castle, he explains to Hercules what happened, to Sinbad. I'm explaining to Hercules.
Never mind.
Anyway, so he also has a vision while he's on the boat of course, because this is, you know, the early 1960s, there's a very sexy girl in a Barbara Eden sort of genie costume who he sees, and on her hand is inscribed an eyeball. It's an eye, like the evil eye, and he sees her in the vision, and he's, you know, what is this horrible thing? And anyway, he doesn't forget about her. She's on his mind. He sees her at the shore before he meets the Grand Vizier. There's a vision again. So that's two times that this girl has appeared to him. So she's magical somehow or other along the way. Well, he gets into the cave. There's a hole in the wall. There's always a hole in the wall, right? There's a hole in the wall in the castle. You know, sometimes they have really good burgers and holes in the wall. Not this one. And I had to. Come on. Anyway, so the king, the vizier, says, this is what happened, Sinbad. We were here, and we were looking at all these artwork and things on here, and we didn't know what it meant. He says, and the vizier found out and puts a ball of fire into the room and destroys almost everything. And he says, and he destroyed my face, which is why he has this gold helmet on. So he has a piece of the gold amulet, very much like Sinbad, only they click together. They're puzzle pieces. And they notice that the thing on the wall that's not been burned away, which I couldn't figure out, looks like it's part of this. So they hold that up to the light, and they see the whole story. Now, meanwhile, one of the Tom Baker, the wizard's terrible, terrible little monsters is now listening into everything. And he's going to run back and tell Tom Baker. He's also able to kind of project what he's seeing to Tom Baker, to the wizard. And he kind of knows what they know now, but then they're going to get rid of this little monster who probably also wants to pick up the amulets again. Anyway, they have a struggle. Sinbad chases Scooch the thing out from under a desk, and the Grand Vizier grabs it, and then he runs. And Sinbad grabs it and it explodes. It goes poof, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of leaves. And the vizier says, oh, my God, it's the wizard's magic. So they set sail now. They're going to talk about going to set sail. And there's a man, I guess some kind of a vendor, played by Frank Dacova. Now, you'll remember him. He was Chief Wild Eagle on F-Troop.
Yes.
Where the heck are we?
Yes, so, I was talking about that yesterday with Athena, the whole and the heck are we and where the heck are we?
Every time I see Frank Dacova, all I can think of is the heck are we's. But anyway, now he has a mustache and he's talking with a kind of a lopsided Arabic accent. And he says to her, to Sinbad, I will help you, you know, if you can help me with this. And I have a problem. I have a lazy bum of a son, and he needs to be taught a lesson. Can you put him on as your crew? I'll give you 400 pieces of gold and, you know, spices, and I'll help provision your ship. And Sinbad says, he's a lazy bum. What do I want him for? In the meantime, the girl shows up, the girl with the inscription on her hand, and she's beautiful. She's very beautiful. And Sinbad's like, wow. And Frank Dacova says, oh, you want her? You can have her. I like fatter girls. She's got a nice figure, but she's too skinny for me. And she's built like, you know, a brick shipyard. I'll be nice. Let's just say like 38, 24, about 37,
39. Uh-huh.
Well, great figure. Very, very 1960s bombshell figure. A lot like Marilyn and Jane Russell and all of those girls back then.
Uh-huh.
The standard size, as they say in Funny Girl. So he says, well, you know, okay. And she gets on the boat with him, and the people on the boat, meanwhile, have a belly dancer on the boat, and she's entertaining them while Sinbad was kind of negotiating. And the king comes, the vizier, who's actually a king, comes on board the boat. And then they get into bad weather, of course, because the wizard is doing rotten things. And they end up on this strange island. Why is it they always end up on a strange island? Any one of them. And they get there, and they go see the seer. We have seers here, too. So they put the two amulets on this, looks like a well. And this thing comes out that looks, it's got the head, the horns of a ram and kind of the face of a demon. And it gives them where they have to go. Meanwhile, the whole crew is hanging out in this cave where this demon is, the wizard and his assistant are up to no good. And they basically put nitroglycerin, it looks like, because it starts to smoke, onto the temple that the cave is in. And it blows up. So they're all stuck there, except Sinbad figures out how to get them out of there. And, of course, he does. And that's not where it ends, of course, because, you know, the wizard is rotten, and he knows where the they think the third piece is. So they get to a part of things that looks like, I don't know, sort of Aborigine, Native American, Asian, and Indian, Indian mixed. Very confusing. Uh-huh. And one of Ray Harryhausen's second miracles comes to life. She is, there was one more on the ship, and I forgot that one. If you remember the movie, they have a map. And the wizard puts a spell on the masthead of the boat, and she comes to life, and she clobbers half the crew. And then she grabs the map. And how she gets it underwater and comes back up is beyond me, with the map being paper. I don't know how that worked out. Somehow they had waterproof paper. I don't know. It was Hollywood, you know, that's how it goes. So getting back to things, now they're on the island. They don't have a map. They don't have any help at all. And they go to the well, and the well tells them where to go. And the wizard blows up the temple. Sinbad makes a bow and arrow out of a table, which, of course, you know, very MacGyver. He sort of gets this iron table. Yeah, very, very, very much MacGyver. Makes a bow and arrow out of an iron table, and he shoots the arrow out into the top of what's left of the well. Meanwhile, the little demon thing is flying around annoying him, and he almost falls off, and somebody else has a bow and arrow. Where that comes from, I don't know either. And they shoot the little demon, and he goes away, and the wizard turns 10 years older, at least. He gets all wrinkled and what have you. And then they get out, and they have to go north. And they go north, and they find the Ray Harryhausen, the wizard. And what happens is the wizard has been captured by these little monsters I was talking about before. And he brings to life a statue of what I would say is Vishnu. He is the dancing goddess, who's also a god sometimes. So Vishnu comes to life and does this beautiful dance. And now they think, the little monsters that have the knives and things at the wizard's throat, that he's a god too. So, and he's the keeper of the dancer, the goddess. So, in the meantime, Sinbad and his crew shows up, and the wizard decides that he's going to have Vishnu kill Sinbad. So he waves his magic hand, and bingo, Vishnu, now dancing, has swords. And there's a whole sword fight, and of course the whole crew gets involved. And the little guy, the lazy little guy, pushes the Vishnu statue off a cliff. Well, off the edge of some kind of a part of the castle. And she breaks into a million pieces. And lo and behold, she had inside her little body the third piece of the puzzle.
Ah.
So now, but Sinbad has destroyed these people's goddess. So, of course, the wizard says, "Get them, boys," and he does. Meanwhile, they're going to kill him. They're going to cut off his head. And the girl screams, and she puts her hand out. And her hand has that eye on it, and they now think she's the sacrifice that they've been waiting for, because they're going to put her into a pit. And why? Because in the pit is one of Ray Harryhausen's most famous monsters, which is the one-eyed Cyclops.
Hmm.
And the Cyclops, in this case, the Cyclops is also a centaur. Same head, you know, he's used this one before. This one has, the Cyclops has a horse's body. And he goes and he grabs the girl and she screams, of course, and, you know, they go after her. And in the meantime, the evil wizard and his crew have gone to the other cave. And somehow or other, you know, Sinbad, who's a hero, of course, thwarts all the whole tribe of little monsters. And he goes into the tunnel where the ogre Cyclops, the centaur, ogre Cyclops centaur, goes. And he finds the girl. Sorry?
The all-purpose monster.
Yeah, well, gee, I was waiting for Medusa, but she didn't happen to show up this one. Anyway, so the next thing that happens is they get into a grand gallery, and Hercules, Sinbad sees the wizard at the well, and he's going to throw the three pieces into the well. He gets to throw two in, and three things are going to happen, and he tells Sinbad. One will be youth and vitality. One will be a shield, a cloak of invisibility. And the third one will be a crown of unbelievably incredible wealth and power. And if he gets all three of them, he becomes the master of the universe, sort of. So in the meantime, the ogre comes out, the ogre Cyclops. And on the other side is a griffin. Now, in Egypt, griffin is a sign for Osiris, who's a positive god. So you have the ogre, who's negative. I always thought he was cute, personally, but that's just me. And then the griffin, who has really terrible, badly. I was mad at Harryhausen. I don't like his wings. They're very strange. They were strangely attached. But they have a fight, and, of course, somebody goes and they attack the griffin. They slice the Achilles tendon, and of course then the ogre Cyclops has his way with him and kills him. And then there's a battle between the ogre and Sinbad and his crew, and somebody throws a spear, of course, and kills the Cyclops ogre. Now the wizard is on his own, but meanwhile the spells have worked. So he now has the cloak of invisibility. He looks about 27. And he's wanting to get the crown of unbelievable, untold wealth. That's how they say it there. And, of course, there's a sword fight. But he's now invisible. So Sinbad can't see the wizard. And the sword, Ray Harryhausen strikes again. The swords are flying all over the place. And Sinbad finally sees that when the grand vizier gets into a waterfall, he's visible. And so Sinbad stabs the wizard, a huge stream of blood. Do you remember? The big thing of blood comes into the waterfall, the fountain, and there's a big stream. It's like a scene in Jaws. There's blood everywhere. And all of a sudden it clears, and then the crown of untold riches comes up out of the water, and you see Sinbad, an image of Sinbad wearing the crown. Mm-hmm. And Sinbad's like, oh, no, you don't. You're not going to stick me with this. And he puts the crown on the vizier's head, and bingo, pow, the vizier suddenly has his own face back. There's a whole scene where it goes from the brass to clear, and suddenly he's this grand vizier, and he's now the caliph, the king. And the girl says, Sinbad, what'd you do that for? You throw away all, you know, women big money. So why did they go that far? And he said, look, I want, the one thing I value more than anything is freedom. He says, the caliph doesn't have freedom. They choose, you know, how he does everything, including who he marries. And he looks over at the girl and she bats her eyelashes and he kisses her, of course. And then the little kid comes down and there's a saying that he says all the way. He says, trust in Allah, but tie up your camel. And it's funnier because in the beginning with the scene with the arrow, the little boy, everybody gives their belt so they can make a rope. So what happens is the kid says, you know, I trust in Allah, and of course his pants fall off. You tie up your cattle. Well, this time he's up on top of the crow's nest. He didn't tie up his camel, right?
No.
So now he's at the end of the movie. He's up on a crow's nest, and he's become an able salesman, seaman, and he's coming. He's going to do something. Talk to Sinbad, and of course he falls off the rope. But falls off the crow's nest. But he has a rope on, you know. And it's trust in Allah, but tie up your camel. And it's a cute ending. Everybody's happy. The caliph is in a gold and white gown robe. He looks regal and kind of good looking. And they sail off, of course, into the Arabian sunset. It's a great movie. It's a lot of fun. Sorry, Hercules.
And the caliph goes on to become a Time Lord from Gallifrey.
Yes.
And...
Well, no. Tom Baker got killed. He's the evil wizard. He doesn't become.
He got
stabbed. He's what caused the huge gush of blood. They killed the wizard.
Okay, I thought he came back.
No. He's not the Grand Vizier. He's an evil prince, and he's an evil wizard.
Gotcha. It's been years since I've seen this. I remember seeing it, and as you described it, I remember bits and pieces of it. But I guess I was not altogether clear on that part of it. Thank you.
It's one of those movies where they say in the beginning it's filmed in Technicolor, and the colors are very bright and vivid. It's actually a very beautiful movie. The Ray Harryhausen special effects, of course, are incredible, and it's just a lot of fun. You know, it's what I used to call a Saturday afternoon adventure film, and that's what Sword and Sandals was all about: adventure and escapism and, you know, beautiful, handsome men and beautiful women. All of the Hercules films had beautiful women and very handsome soldiers and Hercules himself. And this was what this whole genre was about, physical beauty and strength and also using your head besides your muscles. And that was kind of, you know, the thing here. Sinbad was well known to be, you know, very athletic, but he was also known to be clever. And he shows that time and time again in this film. And I loved it because it really, you know, it shows he did the right thing also. He could have taken the crown for himself, but he didn't. He knew that the caliph, I think he knew the magic would restore the caliph. And it's a happy ending, and it's kind of a, you know, look, this guy did the right thing kind of thing. Because Sinbad is also known as a thief, just like the Thief of Baghdad, which is another film one day I'll review. I love it because there are two versions. One is one of the very first movies ever made, which is Douglas Fairbanks Jr., which is in it's black and white, and of course, there's no sound, and he flies across the scene on a flying carpet at the end. And in the 1950s version, if you'll remember, it was Sabu.
Yes, I remember.
And he flies in his 1950s or late 1940s. And it's a beautifully colored film also. It's one I'll discuss another time. But there are other Sinbad movies, which Ray Harryhausen also was involved with. One, of course, had Kerwin Matthews in it. But most of the Ray Harryhausen films did. And Kerwin Matthews, and oddly, Catherine Crosby, Bing Crosby's second wife, is in it.
Wow.
And there's a genie. It's not as good a movie, I will say. It's a lot of fun, but it's not as well done. It's a movie on a shoestring. John Ball turned out.
And they filmed on these real islands a lot of times, some of which had ancient ruins. You know, so they took you on location to these exotic locales because it was cheaper to film there. And so you got that whole dimension that CGI has replaced, but not in terms of the feelings of realism that the earlier films gave you, even though they were...
They filmed a great deal. There's an island called Scorcia. It's off the coast of Calabria, off the coast of the Amalfi Coast in Italy. This is where they filmed a lot of Sword and Sandals films. Many of Hercules' films, the spaghetti, they call them the spaghetti movies. There are a lot of old movie sets still on there. And it's a friend of mine who's a curator, his name is Ralph Demiglio. brought me some pieces at one time. My favorite movie, Cleopatra, was filmed right on that, and the set is still there, and it was used many times over and over again. Yeah, I mean, and the last time I saw parts of it was in the movie, in the series Rome. They had parts of it.
It's a shame they never finished that series. They were going to do a last season or a movie, and they never got around to making it.
Well, they killed off one of the main characters.
Yes.
And, you know, what they were going to do was take Pulo, who was the lead character, and also the guy who plays Pulo died, Ray Starkey. He just recently passed away. But he had gotten involved with the Vikings and a bunch of other things. He was a very talented actor, and he's very much missed.
Yes, he was.
Don Rahl.
Too.
Oh, well, he was 6'6". And I think just about as broad from shoulder to shoulder as well. It was a wonderful situation. But I recommend this movie to everybody. It was a lot of fun. And it's a good thing. It's a good movie to just, on a rain like today when you had a snowy day, it's a good movie to sit back with popcorn and your family and just kind of watch and enjoy.
Yes, very, very, very true. And back then they had the theaters, the matinees, when they had these matinee performances all the time. Now we have cable channels and IMDb.
Well, we binge. But I remember going to, when I lived in Uniondale as a kid in Long Island, we had the Paramount Theater in Roosevelt, which was just over the overpass from me. And we would go to the Paramount Theater and we would watch like three or four of these movies in a row, like a double feature on a day like this. And it was so much fun. And you get popcorn and a garbage can full of Coca-Cola, because they were very big back then. And you just sit there and have a good old time. And I would get my junior mints. I'm sure you did too. And all my goodies. And it was a fun time. You know, it's not the same in the house. And it's not the same when you get it on DVD or you get it, you know, on a streaming service. It's just not the same. It's fun. But this was, it made it an outing, you know, and it was, and my mother liked it because it got us out of the house. You know, she knew, and we weren't causing trouble. We weren't hurt. Nobody was getting hurt. My mom knew we were in the theater. So that was fun.
They used to give out premiums and things like that back in the day as well.
Oh, yeah. They would call out after the movie. They would call out the number of your ticket, and if you got the ticket, you might have won something.
Wow, we only have like a minute left in our time. Time passes very quickly when you're on the show, Sedna.
Well, I thank you. That means you're having a good time, I hope.
I am having a great time.
Let me do what I usually do.
Okay.
I was going to say, people, if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at mkwaterman@icloud.com. You can get me on Facebook at Michael K. Waterman. You can get me on PhonoWizard, which is on the Michael K. Waterman, page, as it were. You can get me on my home number right now, which is 516-650-3691. Although I've moved to Savannah, I have not changed my phone number. There's too many people I'd have to call to change it, and I'm not gonna.
Good.
And of course, if you need to reach me, folks, you can reach me through the almighty Hercules Invictus himself. Thank you.
As you can. Thank you very much, and I enjoyed your review and your memories and your commentary, and I look forward to our next conversation, Sedna. You're awesome.
You got it, Buster. Anytime, Hercules, I'm always here for you. And good night, everybody.
Good night, and thanks again.
You're welcome.
And now on to part two of the show with Brian Walker. Greetings, Brian. How are you?
I'm well tonight, Hercules. How are you feeling?
Feeling not up to par. today's
sorry to hear that.
I heard that you were on the Diana Monfort show.
Yes, I was also on Tim Schwartz's show. as well. And one right after the other. Tim and Gene's show was on Thursday for more than 2.5 hours between the two shows. And then the Diana Monfort show was pretty quick. It was we were in and out in less than an hour.
Fantastic. So I'm glad the word is spreading further and wider than it is already spread.
Usually, you know, podcasters love guests who just can't shut up. So I think that's my appeal.
No, you've been entertaining people on this channel for years now, several times a month.
Great to hear.
Yeah.
I love hearing that.
What are you going to entertain us with today?
Actually, I wanted to talk about a film called The Siege of Syracuse. It was released in 1960, and for a Peplum film, it's bigger. It has a bigger budget, one of the clues to the budget of it is just seeing the cast list. It was directed by the same person who directed the original Steve Reeves Hercules, which was Pietro Fancici. His name is usually associated with the better funded productions in Italian cinema. And that's usually a clue for quality. And this is it's a good film. One of the reasons I wanted to bring it to attention was because just a few days ago, it was actress Tina Louise's birthday. She turned 90 just this last week. And most people will remember her from as Ginger Grant from the CBS TV sitcom in the 60s, Gilligan's Island. But in reality, she did so much more than just Gilligan's Island. And this is one of the films that she did prior to taking on that role on the still wildly popular TV series. that TV series, Gilligan's Island, was not supposed to hit. It was supposed to be a big flop. Everybody who was cast in it thought that it would go off in just a matter of a few weeks, and it didn't. It got picked up. It got popular, and then it was in. It's been on reruns ever since. You know, I think some of the actors, after a while, might have chafed at fans' recollection of them being in this show that they didn't see, that the actor him or herself didn't see as all that great. I think you're better off just being remembered for something at all.
I'm of the same belief.
Yeah, I mean, you shoot your arrow and you see how high it'll go. And, for some of us, we're disappointed. And for others of us, like me, we're very happy with the trajectory. Tina Louise made quite a splash in the late 1950s. And like a lot of actors in the late 50s, she went to Europe to better her fortunes, to see if she could get some better roles, certainly money. European producers typically, although they had pretty tight budgets, typically paid their talent pretty well. And it could be lucrative for now. Keep in mind that I said typically. there have been a few producers who didn't want to pay their casts at all, but for the most part, the Italians paid their talent, and that's why there was such an explosion in the 1960s of European films. That was really their heyday, across the world. If you think about it, there were several film genres that came straight out of Europe. We're talking about one of them right now, which is the peplum. But remember how in the mid to late 60s, spaghetti westerns were incredibly popular. We went to the theater a lot, but we probably saw one a month, if not more than that, if it was a double feature particularly. Europe, always a great place to go, at least in the decade of the 60s, if you wanted to, bolster your career, get a starring role, and, get paid pretty well for it. Remember, the studio system in the 1950s had just sort of collapsed, and studios shed themselves of all of their contract players. And as a contract player under, to a major studio, there were some limitations on the roles that you could take because you had to be within that studio. The nice thing about it was a steady paycheck. You got paid every week. And without the studio system, you didn't have that reliable, steady paycheck. And, let's face it, as I commented today on somebody's on my Facebook post, but somebody's comment on it, actors got to eat,
Right.
you got to pay your bills. And in this film, it's got a great cast, The Siege of Syracuse, Rosanna Brazzi from South Pacific, big star in the late 1950s, is the lead in this. So, again, this was a big production. It looks good on screen, too. I actually ran it as the film of the day on Tina Louise's birthday.
Yes, on Facebook.
Yeah. The version I had access to was the Italian version, and sadly without the option of any kind of subtitles. That is one nice thing about YouTube. You can have almost anything subtitled. Don't have that feature yet with archive.org, unfortunately, at least not in this case. But I did run it because the copy looks fantastic. And, I don't know how many, films that I have watched in the past where I understood very little to none of the dialogue, and still you can still understand what's going on.
If you
pay attention, you have to look at what action's going on screen, of course, but you also pick up subtle hints from the way the actors look at each other, how they speak their lines to each other. You can tell, what's going on after a while. So I went ahead and I thought, let's just go ahead and post that. And, great cast list. Silva Cascina, famous actress from the 1960s and one of the stars of the 1958 version of Hercules. And she's in this as well. And this is pretty early in her career. Early into Tina Louise's career as well. Tina Louise would have been about 25, 26 here. So still, very young. Still establishing her career, although she'd been, she came out of New York television and had been in a few movies. God's Little Acre is probably, of her films, that's probably one of the best known films of hers. Have you ever seen God's Little Acre? It's kind of a steamy potboiler, late 50s.
The name rings a bell. But I don't remember it that much.
It's got a great cast list. And to tell you the truth, it was actually pretty well done for the late 1950s. And not a huge budget film, but also not a cheap movie either. There again, it has a pretty impressive cast list in God's Little Acre. One of my favorites, Aldo Ray, is in God's Little Acre. But there, Robert Ryan, Buddy Hackett, interestingly, Jack Lord from Hawaii 5-0, one of my favorite actresses from the 50s and 60s, Faye Spain, who is the evil queen in Hercules and the Captive Women. Vic Morrow, Lance Fuller. It's got a Michael Landon's in it. It's got a really good cast list. And like I said, it's one of those steamy pot boilers. It promises more than it delivers, but films in the late 50s they were still pretty limited by the Hays Code and could only do so much, really. Certainly couldn't show any skin for the most part. The one way to get around showing skin was to do documentaries on nudist colonies.
Yes,
for Pasta
yes.
Back then. And
I
and
have
so
some.
There was a. Oh yeah, the director Doris Wishman, who made some really fun but god awful movies in the 60s and 70s, was notorious or famous, whichever word you want to pick, for shooting films in nudist colonies. And I think this is it's one of Greg's favorite films, but Blaze Star Goes Nudist.
Yes.
Is a Doris Wishman film. And don't ask me how I got from Tina Louise to Doris Wishman, but there we are. But anyway, you've seen that. I'm positive we talked about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I've seen it, and I have it. I have it on the same DVD as a movie about the moon. Where
Nude on the Moon?
Nude on the Moon, yes.
Yes, yes. What's interesting about those films is that, and I keep in mind, I don't know that anybody watched those for erotic fulfillment.
No,
they
weren't really erotic at all.
No, not a bit. Because you can watch it now. You can watch it now and think, well, this would have shocked audiences back then, but really it shouldn't have. Because there's just nothing erotic about it.
No, there isn't.
But Blaze Star Goes Nudist, like I said, one of Greg's favorite films. If you have an appreciation of high camp, it may be one of your favorite films as well. There is no higher recommendation than, in my estimation, than calling something high camp, which means it's unintentionally funny.
And that they were.
Oh, it is, and some more than others, but Blaze Star Goes Nudist is right there at the top of being extremely campy. Now, going back to Tina Louise and Siege of Syracuse, I really think this is one of the peplums that gets overlooked, and I'm not really sure why, because it's not my, I will say this, it's not my favorite peplum film, mm-hmm. but it's also not a terrible one. And you can see that the production values on it are very high, you know, especially for that time period. And for Italy, you know, it seems like as many Italian films as I've seen, you would almost swear that Italy rivaled Hollywood. You know, in terms mm-hmm. of output and size. But really, I mean, they were kind of upstarts, you know, and the Italian cinema grew almost in spite of itself, you know, really.
Mm-hmm.
And made quite a mark. Some of my favorites, I hate to sound like such a cliche, but some of my favorite films are Italian films.
Yeah, in terms of peplum, so were mine.
Well, in terms of peplums, I mean, they're 99% Italian films. But going into other genres that the Italian cinema pretty much invented, we mentioned spaghetti westerns, but there's also the giallo, which combines well, I should say, elements of mystery and horror. Mm-hmm. You got some of those movies in the 30s and 40s out of Hollywood, actually. I can't really say that the Italians invented, films where mystery and horror lines blur, because you saw that in a lot of 1940s Universal horror films. A lon of the ones that Lon Chaney starred in, they were as much crime dramas as they were anything else, but they had elements of horror in them, too. But the Italians sort of took it to the next level, made them hyper-violent, gory. That is one thing I really appreciate about a lot of European filmmakers, particularly the Italians, is that I don't want to say that they lack subtlety, but they tend to go over the top. Even if you look at the colors and the lighting in a lot of Italian films, I mean, the sets are lit up like Christmas trees. You could land 747s. They've got light pumped in like crazy. Now, when you do that, it makes the colors very bright and vivid. And, you know, for you outdoor spectacles, it certainly makes sense, even if you have to go into the studio to do it. But it does give you that almost otherworldly vivid color that you only saw in Elvis films, you know, back in the Technicolor look. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean.
But that also adds to the spectacle. You know, I'm not really sure what we get out of our dollar or however much it costs these days to go to the theater, because I haven't been to one in 5 years and couldn't really tell you. But back then, you know, if you spent your nickel, the director, the producers, you know, somebody wanted to, you know, provide a spectacle, give you something to look at, hopefully not too mundane. And I'm not sure you always get that now.
No, you don't. And the opportunity to go to a theater is greatly diminished too. All our neighborhood theaters, and we had three of them within short driving distance, are closed now. Some of them are done by the pandemic, some of them by other forces beyond their control. But my wife and I used to go on date night once a month, or sometimes more, and they would just basically be going to a movie, going out after dinner, and, you know, just chilling and enjoying each other and the food and the entertainment. But we can't do that anymore. You know, we can still go out, but we don't see a movie.
And, you know, it's really sad. And as much as film has really shaped, you know, my life, in terms of, you know, trying to see as many of them as possible and having a pretty decent physical collection, I'm kind of turned off by contemporary cinema. And I do think that there is something to be said about the actual experience of going to the theater, whether it's a drive-in or whether it's a physical theater. The megaplexes, I don't know. It just seems it's too Walmart for me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's nothing quaint about it. They're not really particularly comfortable either. And I don't know what's going to happen to the traditional theater. I think we're going to see far fewer of them in the next 5 or 10 years than we have right now. And unfortunately, it's the really cool little theaters that are going to close
Yes.
first. The ones that have been there for, you know, 60, 70, 80 years that also cost less to go to, might I add, usually.
Right.
Most, and they do have a, you know, sort of a homey atmosphere. Those are the ones that are going to go.
And they have the matinee.
And you'll probably see some.
If you want to go see a movie on the cheap, you can go see a matinee and enjoy the film for a few dollars, and a lot less than you would have paid if you went during a prime time.
Well, now I'm not even sure you can float matinees, because I'm not sure who's going to go to the theater at noon.
Yeah.
Now, you know, when I was a teenager, that especially in the summer, you know, if you didn't have like the obligation of school or a part-time job, you were able to go to, you know, the first showing. And you're right, it was like half price. That's what I recall anyway. But it was significantly cheaper.
Yes.
To go to the matinee. And there was also the added benefit too, is I hate being in a really crowded theater. I don't hear very well, especially out of my left ear. Everything thuds, and in crowded situations, it all just becomes muddled for me, so I can't hear anything at all. All I can hear is this roar, you know. But if I do go to a theater, I do love it when they're just empty. You know, and that's against community, I suppose. But it also means that I can hear a lot better.
Yeah, I'm starting to lose the hearing in my ears as well. And usually it's my left ear where I can't hear as well. Sometimes my right ear So my ears kind of take turns. Had that experience as well.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why anymore. I mean, I love getting out of the house, and there are, I cannot say that I'll never go to another theater again, because that's not true. And I fully anticipate going to one in the future for a particular reason. I do like the Fandango events. Those were pretty popular, at least before COVID, where they would either bring a movie back for, you know, a day or two, you know, like an old classic film. Several years ago, they did that with Jaws, and we went to see the cleaned up new copy of it, which was fun. We had a good time. We did that with several other old films, just seeing them on the screen. We met friends there too. And we knew a lot of people who were going. So it was more communal in that respect. It was a lot of fun. To go. I would love to do something like that again. And I also have kind of an addiction to IMAX. The very last movie that I saw before the pandemic started was at an IMAX theater. And I love sort of being surrounded by the film. You're enveloped by it. The sound really draws you in as well. And for some reason, the sound with IMAX, I don't know if it's channeled differently or what, but I don't have the trouble hearing it because it's not making my eardrums pop. I don't know why, but maybe it's just the quality of it. I don't know.
I haven't been to an IMAX theater for over a decade and a half. I think when Thor came out, we saw it in the IMAX theater. Marvel's.
Well, the one that we go to the most often is in your neck of the woods. Well, I know you're not really that close to Atlantic City, but used to go to the one in Atlantic City a lot.
Yeah, we're not close. It's not a neighborhood theater. It's like the other side of the state. It is in the same state.
Yeah, but anyway, about going back to Tina Louise, she actually made another Peplum film, one that I do not have access to, which the American title is The Warrior Empress. It was made at the same time, around 1960, and it has the same director, so I'm going to guess that they were probably made back-to-back. Now, her male co-star in this was another actor who went to Europe because, you know, his career in Hollywood hadn't gone quite well. And that's Kerwin Matthews, who did a lot of swashbucklers in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And it's a fun film to watch as well, and I recommend taking a look at it. If you're a Tina Louise fan, that is great. But if you like Peplum films, I think these are two that get overlooked quite often. They're not, again, I don't think that they're the best Peplum films on earth, but they're very well produced, and if nothing else, they're very good eye candy. And the quality of the performances is very good, too.
My cousin Ron is a big Tina Louise fan, and I remember years ago I'm questing for those two movies. It took a while. I don't know if he ever got both of them, but I know he got one of them.
And she's in one of my favorite movies from the 1970s, The Stepford Wives. She has a good supporting role. Yeah, she has a good supporting role in it. And I can still remember watching The Stepford Wives, seeing The Stepford Wives for the first time. Really kind of blew me away. And, you know, 50 years later, I still think that its message still resonates, I think.
Yes, it most certainly does.
Yes, it may be more now than it did then, if you think about it.
Yes, that's true. I heard that she doesn't like talking about Gilligan's Island in the interviews.
Well, you know, I'll bet over the last 60 years that she has been asked the same dozen questions about the TV series, you know, and she was one of the actors who wasn't crazy about being locked into the role, which meant that she couldn't do anything else. You know, she couldn't,
right.
She couldn't go off and do a film if she wanted to, or she couldn't take a role in a Broadway play. It's very limiting. Back then anyway, now nobody would sign a contract that said you couldn't do anything
right.
else. They just wouldn't. But back then, you know, they had you. And there again, that was, you're under contract to a studio, and they pretty much owned you. So there are good things and bad things about being under contract, especially when they run from year to year and not movie to movie.
And today the clock is again our enemy. I enjoy speaking with you, and we always get to a point where it's a couple of minutes till the end of the show, and there's still many things to say. So fortunately, we speak fairly often. So to be continued, and I'm glad that you're going further afield in your podcasts, and we'll soon be doing your own thing entertainment-wise.
If I ever... if I ever get up and finally do it, yes. But I fully plan to get it going.
And how can people reach Brian's Drive-In Theater and
well,
get in contact with him? I'm sorry.
You can always, that's okay. You can always point your browser to briansdriveintheater.com. That's Brian with an I. Also, if you would like to see what I'm posting on social media, I only post on Facebook these days. And you can find me on the web at Brian Walker or Brian's Drive-In Theater, and I should pop up. You can also you find me on the web and then hook up with me on Facebook through the Drive-In Theater website.
And any new evolutions to your site? We've been keeping track of those, and there have been many, and it's been ongoing. Anything new and exciting?
Well, over the last 4 or 5 weeks, I've gone through the entire site, every page. And,
oh, wow.
it's been a minute, let me tell you. I've gone through every page and stripped all of the Amazon ads, stuff off of it, so no more of that. I also went back in and fixed a few things that the World Wide Web Consortium had deprecated, you know, things that it says, you know, we don't need to do this anymore in terms of HTML code.
Okay.
So I fixed all of that. And, you know, as always, every time I go into a page, I find another typographical error or some other mistake. So I've tried to go through and correct some issues. And right before tonight's podcast, I found another one that I've got to go back in and fix. It's necessary. I think it makes a lot of sense to go back through the site at least once a year, every page, and update and make sure that it's compliant so that different readers can pick it up and it's accessible for everybody.
The robot voice is holding at 90 seconds. Thank you so much, Brian. Always a pleasure. Say hi to Greg, and I look forward to our next conversation, which should be relatively soon.
Well, take care, Hercules, and I hope you feel better soon.
Yeah, thank you for being understanding and letting me merge the two shows, because I've really been out of it today.
No, that works for me anytime.
Okay, be well, my friend.
You too, Hercules. Take care.
You too. And thanks to all those who tuned in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called in and you're patiently waiting in the queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody.